Great, thanks. So my talk, or my paper, along with the others, as you can see here, we had a very large group of people who worked together, which made it a very rich discussion and interchange. So we had, as I get into the paper, you'll see why it was so important to have so many different people. And I have no personal financial relations to disclose. So there are about 39 million low-income workers in the United States. That's 31% of all workers in the United States would be considered low-income. And this slide just shows you some of the most important occupations of low-income workers that employ the largest number of workers. And so it includes occupations like hand packers, food service workers, home care workers, cashiers, child care workers, and housekeepers, house cleaners. And just given the occupations, you also know from the types of people who work in these occupations that they're more likely to be female, they're more likely to be African American or Hispanic, foreign born, and not to have a high school diploma. And we've heard before from various, the other two presentations, and I'm sure you all know that these kinds of occupations give rise to a number of health outcomes, whether it's by work organization, discrimination, or exposure to chemical, physical, or other exposures. But health disparities for these populations also arise from disproportionate exposures in the community. So, for instance, many of the communities that low-income and particularly low-income minority workers live in have higher rates of air pollution, higher concentrations of hazardous waste facilities. They're also more likely to have access to fast food restaurants, like you can see in this picture, and not have access to full-service grocery stores and grocery stores, sort of corner drug stores, as you can see here. And also live in communities with high rises with little green space, so there's less opportunity for leisure time activities and parks, and also communities that might give rise to higher levels of violence, which may keep people inside their homes instead of out in the community. So our challenge in trying to think about decreasing health disparities is to look at some of these systematic causes of underlying causes that lead to health disparities. And many people, when they've talked about this, is that we're really seeing some violations of fundamental human rights, that people have different access to good communities, good workplaces. And therefore, people give rise to this term health equity as opposed to using the term health disparities, which is sort of more neutral. And what we tried to talk about in our paper is to really think about how to create integrated programs that acknowledge the combined and interacting factors that exist at the workplace, at home, and in the community, because we've tended, even within public health, to be very siloed. So, you know, there's lots of people over there in the other building who are talking about food deserts and lack of leisure activities and other sorts of things, and we're over here talking about the workplace, and really what we need to do is become more integrated. So we took on this challenge to think about how this can be done, and we developed our own conceptual framework like others had, and we use this framework that's been called the social ecological framework. And what it does is it looks at various levels of interaction. So at the individual level, you may have individuals that have less knowledge about good eating habits or how to use personal protective equipment. At the interpersonal level, you may have supervisors who are not supportive of healthy environments or families that are not supportive. At the organizational level, you can have workplaces that are more or less supportive in terms of health and safety, and communities that develop programs like farmers markets and other sorts of things. At the community level, You can have economic factors that influence what kinds of jobs are available, what kinds of housing is available, and also at society there's policies that determine how exposures are controlled in the workplace and exposures in the community. So what we did in our paper is we looked at four venues in which public health programs take place: at the workplace, community health centers, health departments, and community-based programs. And we looked to see how people have been moving forward and taking the challenge of how to integrate work-related and non-work-related factors for low-income populations. So I'll be able to just very quickly give you a snippet of some of the things that we found as we explored this, and you could look at the paper to hear more details. So we first looked at the workplace, and we looked at traditional worksite health promotion programs, which have been effective but very limited. So you have things like Weight Watchers programs at the workplace or smoking cessation programs. And then there's been some newer programs that have looked at institutional changes, like putting vending machines in that sell healthy foods or having exercise facilities located in the workplace. But one of the limitations of these kinds of programs is that they're not available in most workplaces. They tend to be focused in larger workplaces that have bigger infrastructure and more economic resources. And also these kinds of programs that compartmentalize and look at, like weight loss, they don't address some of the underlying organization of work factors that Paul had just talked about. So we looked at some of the new wave of participatory workplace programs, and these are programs that empower workers to create their own programs and make decisions within the workplace, and talk about how the act of participation in itself and thinking about how to create a program that works for a particular workforce can transform the workplace by allowing workers to feel like they have more control and authority in decision making, and in itself can lead to decrease in work stress. And we looked specifically at a case study in a nursing home in Massachusetts where workers were involved in developing both safe lifting programs and also how to provide healthier food within their cafeteria. We then looked at community health centers. So as we know, many of the low-income populations don't have access to health insurance. They also, because of intimidation in the workplace, may not access work-related programs for work-related injuries and illnesses. And so therefore, community health centers become an extremely important venue for reaching out to low-income workers. And so we looked at many different models that have been created in community and migrant health centers where people are trying either through the venue of electronic health records or through information systems or through having hotlines where community clinicians can get a hold of occupational or environmental practitioners to get information to help treat their patients. And the other thing we looked at is the new phenomena of community health workers. And this is something that has been written into the new health reform law, which will be a program to develop more community workers who are affiliated with clinics but are actually working in the clinic, and talked about models by which community health workers are trained on environmental and occupational health risk factors as well as workers' compensation. The third venue we looked at was public health departments. As we all know, health equity is central to the mission of public health departments, and part of what they do is to develop health tracking programs as a key component of what they do. And through these health tracking or surveillance programs, looking at disparities can be an important way of integrating both work and non-work related factors. Also, health departments have great dissemination systems for reaching underserved workers, like through school health programs, through health inspectors, and through refugee health programs. And also because they sit in a place where they look both at work-related and community factors, they're in a position to develop more comprehensive programs that look at this. So, for instance, we looked at a youth violence prevention program developed in Massachusetts, where violence at work can be one element of a comprehensive violence prevention program. So finally, we looked at community-based participatory research and training programs. These are programs that are involve the community in building local capacity, look at institutional and policy solutions. And because they're based in the community, they can also be very useful in reaching immigrant workers, others who are intimidated at the workplace, who are changed, different work in different workplaces. So we looked at the environmental justice research programs as one example, and also the minority worker training programs, which are programs which now have trained thousands of workers in learning how to do environmental remediation within their communities. So it both is providing economic development as well as training them about how to create better workplaces and cleaner environments. So we looked at a number of recommendations, including how to improve data collection with the idea that if it's not counted, it doesn't exist. So we therefore need to better count work-related factors. We looked at programs to increase education and training that go across programs for workers, professionals, policymakers, exchanging information about the interacting effects between work and community exposures, increasing worker and community participation in all facets, and supporting greater research to evaluate these various approaches so that they can become better integrated.